Journal podcast. I'm your host, Jason Berlindi. As always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. And for the next few weeks, let's say the entire month of June, I've got some bonus episodes for you. This is one of them. You're going to have more than one Fretboard Journal podcast per week. And the reason why is because we have some timely stuff we need to talk about. First up is today's guest, field editor for the Fretboard Journal, John Thomas. John has been a tireless contributor to the Fretboard Journal since its inception, has wrote numerous articles on builders and playing, and his latest contribution appears in the brand new Fretboard Journal's 52nd issue, which I know a lot of you have been waiting for. He writes about the two dozen or so guitars that the late entrepreneur Scott Chinnery amassed. Scott basically commissioned 20 or so of the greatest guitar makers alive at the time to build the ultimate archtop guitar, and he wanted them all in the same shade of blue. The blue guitar collection, the Scott Chinnery blue guitar collection, ended up going to the Metropolitan Museum. It has been acquired by the nonprofit Archtop Foundation and is going to be traveling the world and being played by some of the greatest musicians alive. And most importantly, staying intact, which is a really cool thing. And John wrote about that, interviewed the players at hand, talked about the guitars and some of the quirky history behind some of these commissions. And it's a great piece. It, again, is in our new 52nd issue. If you are not a subscriber to the Fretboard Journal, what are you waiting for? You can join us at fretboardjournal.com by clicking on that subscribe button. And as 2023 unfolds, we're going to be offering all sorts of cool perks just for subscribers beyond the magazine itself, including some bonus content and discounts and things you're not going to be able to find on social media or even our website. You're only going to be able to find them as a subscriber to the magazine. It's a pretty cool thing. So like I said, John is one of our favorite guitar writers. He's also one of my favorite human beings to talk to. He has had an absolutely incredibly difficult last few years on the health front. He's also one of the fittest people I know. So we've got that weird contradiction. And literally today, June 4th, 2023, John is en route to Banff, Canada, where he is going to ride a gravel bike from Banff to the U.S.-Mexico border in New Mexico. This is part of a truly arduous endurance race called the Great Divide, and John is going to be participating and trying to hold his own. And I wanted to talk to him, have him reflect a little bit on the journey that he's about to take, the journey that he's been on, guitars, of course, and a lot more. It's a pretty amazing conversation with one of the most enthusiastic and life-filled humans you will ever talk to. I am going to be driving my car to Montana with my bike and trying to keep up with John for about a day. That's going to be super fun. But if John is passing through your town, if anybody lives along the Great Divide, reach out to him. Reach out to me. I can help put you in touch. I know John would appreciate meeting some Fretboard Journal readers and podcast listeners along his journey. Our podcast is brought to you by a handful of brands that love what we are about, and I want you to love what they are up to. Peghead Nation, one of the great music instruction portals around. Another friend of the Fretboard Journal podcast and the Fretboard Summit, Matt Munisteri, has a new class on Peghead Nation called Western Swing Guitar with Matt Munisteri. You are going to want to try that, and you can try it and get your first month free or $20 off of any annual subscription with the promo code Fretboard when you check out. Our friends at StringJoy Strings are still offering you 10% off of your first order at stringjoy.com. Just use the promo code Fretboard. Deering Banjos is sponsoring the podcast once again. One of the great American instrument-making brands. They have an entire lineup of banjos, from starter banjos like their Good Time all the way up to the most fancy, ornate, over-the-top presentation-grade banjo you can imagine. Check out what they're up to. If you're banjo curious, the Good Time banjo series you really can't go wrong with. And they have something at pretty much every price point, though. It's pretty cool. And then last but not least, Our friends at Isotope and Native Instruments and Plug-In Alliance have launched their Summer of Sound, their biggest annual sales special. You can get 50% or more off of their software and even deeper discounts on Isotope upgrades. I will include a link to the Native Instruments Isotope and Plug-In Alliance Summer of Sound sale. Tell them the Fretboard Journal podcast sent you. Again, this is a bonus episode. I'm still going to throw a number on it. Also in June, we're going to have more bonus episodes, including one where I go through the new Fretboard Journal's 52nd issue, which a lot of you are going to start seeing in your mailbox in the immediate future. And also, I want to give you some very cool Fretboard Summit updates that are late breaking. So if you haven't gotten your tickets yet to our Big Guitar Hang in Chicago, August 24th, please go to fretboardsummit.org and sign up while you still can. And now, here is my conversation with guitar journalist, law professor, and adventure endurance athlete. I don't know what else to call him, John Thomas. John, thank you for being on the podcast. I think this is your fourth appearance, which puts you at the upper echelon of Fretboard Journal podcast appearances. I think only you and TJ Thompson have done that. So congrats.
Well, why don't we split this into two or three? And then I can have sole leadership, right? And I get free beer or something at the Fretboard Summit, right?
Yeah, you'll get the free beer anyways.
I want to beat out TJ. So let's split it into at least two, maybe three.
Okay. Yeah. We'll really stretch it out, serialize it. And you've been a loyal and amazing contributor to the Fretboard Journal since its inception, really. And your most recent contribution appears in the new issue that's going to be hitting everyone's mailbox in the next week or two, which is all about Scott Chinnery's Blue Guitar Collection.
It was a fun piece to write.
Yeah. You got to see, how many of those guitars did you actually play?
All of them.
All of them. What was your favorite? What was your least favorite?
I think my two twin favorites would be the Tequisto and the Monteleone. I think those were just extraordinary instruments, just in every kind of way. I wish I had jazz chops to really bring out tone in an arch top, but for those two, I didn't need any chops at all. I could just hold it in my lap and would play without touching it. It would play great jazz guitar. It just extraordinary response and sounds that I don't expect from an arch top, especially as a person who doesn't have the technique to make them sound that great. My least favorite, I think, is everybody's least favorite. It's the Deleco, which was supposedly Chinnery took that guitar just because it was bad, and so he could have the ridiculous and the sublime. But other than that one, they're all really great guitars. One of my other favorites is Kim Walker's guitar. As Kim says, Scott just asked everybody to build their absolute best, and that's what they did. So these were uniformly really great guitars.
Yeah. And if anyone's been living under a rock for the last couple of years, a nonprofit group has purchased the entire famous blue guitar collection that Scott Chinnery amassed, and it is traveling the country and visiting and being played by many great musicians. It's going to be at the Fretboard Summit that we're throwing in August in Chicago. And it's cool that those, I mean, how rare is it that a guitar collection stays intact? So,
yeah, it's cool. And I've been flexing my Fretboard Journal chops. And now that once we split this to two, I'll be the premier appearer on the podcast. I'll have even more Fretboard Journal chops. I've been just grabbing friends and dragging them in and putting the guitars in their hands. And the people who, nonprofit and those folks, assisting a nonprofit and schlepping the guitars around, are too embarrassed to tell me I can't do that. So look me up at the summit and I'll drag you in and put $500,000 Tequisto in your hands.
I want to see the one that everybody likes the least. Does it just weigh like 20 pounds and sound awful? Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, on both counts.
It weighs as much as a Les Paul. The top must be a quarter of an inch thick, right? But I can tell you that at the Woodstock Festival, there was a young couple, man and woman, who came in, and the woman was a visual artist. And she came over and was just enamored with that guitar and said, "This is the best. This is the most beautiful." And her partner played it, and they both proclaimed it to sound fantastic. So maybe it isn't the finest, maybe it's the worst among a group of really good guitars. But that said, there's really no. It's no shame in being the worst among the 20 plus whatever finest archtops ever made.
Yeah. Is that builder still alive? Whoever that is?
No, it was a mini consortium for Gold. It was a couple of guys who formed this company. They had just begun, and Scott had not asked them to build a blue guitar. They just built one and sent it to him, and he decided to keep it. Yeah, okay. Kind of cheeky. As best I could understand, Scott appreciated the cheek and said, "Yeah, I'll keep it," and knew it was bad. But this is the blue guitar for the proletariat. So, interesting story. And as best I know, they didn't last too long.
Yeah. Well, if any aspiring luthiers are out there listening to this, the Archtop Foundation is commissioning new blue guitars from the current crop of builders. So you could just make one, it sounds like, and keep it in the spirit of this group.
Right. Now, I don't know if these people appreciate cheek as much as Scott did, but I think it's worth a try, right?
Yeah.
I don't know what happens
kit or
if
something.
They just,
yeah.
What if the foundation decides it doesn't like it? They just leave it outside by the curb. Or sell it or send it back. I don't know. I think do it. This is worth at least a fretboard journal story, if not a documentary. You know, the lost blues, the rejected blues. It's got a title. Let's do it.
Yeah. These guitars are going to be at the summit. They are in our brand new 52nd issue, which I'm super proud of. And I can't thank you enough for your contribution. I think you are also in the very, very rarefied world of you've been to every fretboard summit, haven't you?
I have. And I've enjoyed them. They've been just astonishing.
I think only three or four people in the world have been to all three fretboard summits and are coming to the fourth, which so that's even rare.
So could we pay off the other two or three, not to 10. So again, I can have premier status.
Yeah, I think it's Chris Young and TJ Thompson and myself. And you wouldn't have to pay me much to miss my own event. That's fine.
Yeah. So the offer's out there, folks. I want to be the only one to have attended them all. So just let me know what your price is. Jason has paid me so much for this Blue Guitars article. I'm flush with cash. So just let me know. I'll cover your cost.
That's print publishing in 2023, folks. John, you among your many exploits, guitar and life related, we've shared a bunch of them, I think, on the last podcast, which was like 2 or 3 years ago that we had you. We talked about some of your health issues and also some of your projects beyond Kalamazoo Gals and all the great guitar writing that you've done. You are literally about to tomorrow embark upon one of the coolest adventures I've ever heard. It's not really guitar related, but you're part of our family and I wanted to check in. Explain what the last couple of years have looked like and then explain what starts tomorrow.
So I've had an interesting about 3 years or so.
Yeah.
In fact, my cancer hospital, that's a little hint of what's coming here, published a post on social media talking about me. So over the course of the last 3 years, in late 2019, I received a probable diagnosis of prostate cancer, and then a nearly definitive diagnosis in early 2020. The next step would be a biopsy to make sure it really was cancerous, what this MRI and blood tests were revealing or hinting at. And so before I could get that biopsy, this little virus you might have heard of called COVID descended upon the universe, and I contracted COVID. This is before people knew really what it was. It's before there was any kind of treatment. And I remember being at the Yale New Haven Hospital out here in New Haven, Connecticut. And it looked like, I never served in the military, but it looked like a triage service at a military hospital that I'd seen, or any sort of hospital situation where there's been some sort of horrific event. There were stretchers lined out to the sidewalk. We had to wait to get in. I was lucky enough that they ran out of intubation machines. And so I wasn't intubated, but I recovered from that, survived long enough to get the very first biopsy that Yale offered in 2020, which revealed my cancer was relatively advanced, got the very first surgery for prostate cancer Yale did in 2020 because of the pandemic. So that would be July 1st of 2020.
Wow.
I had my prostate and a dozen lymph nodes ripped from my body by a six-armed robot, which sounds horrible, but it was incredible. So instead of slicing you open with a giant butcher knife and moving around with your hands, your doc sits at a gaming console outside the room while this robot It's like six little arms with razor sharp knives, pulls all this stuff out and leaves little tiny scars. Pretty amazing. I remember making sure that my surgeon, my urologist surgeon, was sufficiently accomplished that he had done, or she, he in this case, had done a number of these surgeries, but young enough, they'd grown up with, you know, Mario Kart or whatever. I'm too old to have those prehensile thumbs. I really wanted to make sure it was a young enough person. And this is actually true, right? These people are playing video games, and that you need to have both that medical knowledge, but also this bizarrely new, at least to me new, last decade or so, fine motor skill, which is an operating machine. So that went well. I was an avid cyclist at the time, and there's an app called Strava, which wacko cyclists and runners put their data up on the internet so that people could compare how much self-sacrifice, self-punishment you're imposing upon yourself. And in that time, a friend set up a Strava segment in the hospital hallway outside my room so that I could set the all-time record called King of the Mountain, even though it was flat, you'll call it King of the Mountain. So I was dragging my my IV tube bottle carrier and a catheter bag in the other hand and walking up and down the hallway as fast as I can. Didn't matter because no one else did it, except the all-time record in Yellow Haven's third floor West Wing or something such. All went swimmingly until about a year later, and my DSA, prostate-specific antigen, which is it's a molecule, really a protein molecule that the prostate produces, started going up again. And if you don't have a prostate, you shouldn't have this prostate-specific antigen. It meant that my surgeon did not get all my cancer. And so I went in for radiation. I did 8 weeks of daily radiation, Monday through Friday. And alas, it turned out that the radiation didn't sufficiently cook what remained of my cancer. So in the last, about 6 months ago, my PSA started rising again, indicating that I need some other kind of treatment. And curiously, once the cancer gets outside of the prostate area, it becomes incurable, not untreatable, but incurable. And the next step in treatment in this country is something known as androgen deprivation therapy, ADT. It's hormone therapy, otherwise known in the medical literature as chemical castration. So not a nice thing, especially for someone who's relatively athletic like I am. And it's, cancer cells are smart enough that they can eventually mutate. They need this testosterone to thrive, but not to survive. So once they've been subjected to this hormone therapy, they mutate, and then you have to figure out something else to do about it. And in the meantime, I also got COVID two more times. I recommend cancer as a journey, but I don't recommend embarking on that journey during a pandemic. Pandemics and cancer are not a good mix. So that's where I stand. It's been fascinating. I will say, in some ways, a gift. I mean, a horrific gift in a lot of ways. But I tell people, if you ever want to learn grace, go get radiation therapy. It's painless. You go every day at the same time, just for scheduling purposes. I think I was 2:45 in the afternoon, whatever it is. And then it's a 15-minute or so session. So you'll meet people just before your session who come early, or just after your session, you come early. So you meet these people on either side of your time period, and they're all in different phases of treatment. It may be the first day, maybe their last day. And so what happens is every single day you find somebody who has a worse outlook than you have, right? Prognosis, worse prognosis, but they're still trying their best to be happy and productive. And it is humbling, fills you with gratitude. It was extraordinary. I actually have some nostalgia for that time in my life. I mean, you know, it's a weird kind of nostalgia. And what I did was I mapped out a 5-mile route. So it was 10-mile round trip on my bicycle with a big hill halfway, so that I could measure how the radiation slowly made me get more and more tired. But I made it to every single one by bicycle. So that's where I stand.
And just to ask, are you going to do this hormone replacement therapy?
So I don't know. The hormone replacement therapy is really a prerequisite to any more sophisticated, more modern therapy in the U.S. Mm-hmm. In the U.K. and EU, it is not. Why, you ask? Because this drug called Lupron costs about $7 a vial. And so it puts off any other treatment. And as a result, because it's so cheap, health insurers will not cover you for any other treatment until your cancer becomes castration resistant, literally the terminology. My guess is that I come back and instead of embarking on the hormone therapy, I find a provider in the EU. I know some people who've done that. It would take some careful consultation with various physicians, but I'm not particularly happy with the nature of our healthcare system, especially with these third-party payers, right? So the job of the insurance company is to deny as much as possible so that they make more money for their shareholders. And I've had several confrontations with my insurer. I'm lucky in that I'm a recovering lawyer, been a professor for a long time, but I just threatened to sue them. I said, fine, I'll sue you, meet you in court. And they back down every time. It makes me worry about people who don't have that kind of training or that kind of confidence, or my goodness, don't speak English as a first language. How do you address this? It's been enlightening and horrible.
Yeah. And this other therapy is not offered from our neighbors to the north or south either. You have to go to the EU.
You have to go to the EU to get good access to it. It's really sort of targeted radiation, little seeds that float in and do some magic inside your body. We have clinical trials going on in the U.S. right now, including my urologist at Yale is heading up a collaboration, Yale and Mayo Clinic. But I got this cancer just a couple of years too early, I think. That's what it looks like.
So lest anyone thinks that you are, bedridden or just, recovering from all the things you just documented, I know this is a guitar podcast, but you're traveling to Canada tomorrow. We're talking on June 3rd. You're traveling on the 4th of June to embark on something that is such a wild adventure. I need you to explain it. I'm not going to do it justice.
Well, I've been calling this my most audacious attempt ever in my life. So I will be entering the world's longest mountain bike race that begins in Banff, Canada, known as the Tour Divide, travels along the Continental Divide, which are the Rocky Mountains of the U.S., from Banff, Canada, south to the Mexican border in New Mexico, U.S.-Mexican border in New Mexico. It goes up and down the Rockies, 200,000 feet of climbing, and it is a self-supported bikepacking race. So bikepacking is what you think it sounds like. It's backpacking on a bicycle. So the participants carry all their camping gear and food and water on bicycles and camp out. Or if you happen through some small lonely town with a hotel, you can use the hotel, but it's self-supported. And I call it participants. I'm not racing per se. There will be the finest endurance athletes around the planet will be lining up that same day. I will line up behind them. My goal is to document, well, one is to enjoy every pedal stroke. Given my health circumstances, I don't know that I'll ever be able to do something like this again, but also to document the event for the cancer community or anybody who's suffered some sort of serious physical challenge. So I'll be carrying along a GoPro and a drone and, of course, my cell phone. And we'll be writing a book about it, that little fold-out keyboard that attaches via the magic of Bluetooth to my phone to document what I'm calling crossing the divides. So there, of course, are international divides I'll be crossing, the U.S.-Mexico border and the U.S.-Canadian border. Talk about the divide between those who have facing a serious physical ailment and those who don't. But also a lot of the journey goes through rural America, the rural West, and much of that area has been designated by the federal government as underserved medical communities. So places where doctors and very little access to healthcare of any kind, especially mental health care. So I'm going to try to reflect on all of that.
Incredible. I mean, this is like the bike equivalent of most people have heard of the Appalachian Trail, or on the West Coast, we have the Pacific Crest Trail. This is the bike equivalent of this. Everything, sleeping bag, tent, all your changes of clothing on you, food, bear canister, all that fun
stuff.
Did
you mention changes of clothing? Carrying two of everything. That's it.
You also, knowing you as well as I do, glossed over the fact when you were documenting the health issues that you were supposed to do this last year, but weeks before the race, weeks before the ride, you were on a training ride and you clipped a deer and punctured both lungs. Am I getting this right?
Yeah. So I was training for this was May 15th. So it was about a little less than a month, 3 weeks away from the start of June 8th last year, I think it was, like a few weeks away. And I'd done my training ride, which is laps of, over this in this dirt road over a hill near me, so I can get in 5 or 6,000 miles of feet of climbing in a 40 mile ride, something like that. And then heading back home on a paved road, slightly downhill, going at about 30 miles an hour, which is fast-ish on a bicycle, but not that horribly fast. But in any event, a deer came bounding out of the shrubbery right next to the road and collided. I remember looking at the poor deer with it, you know, looked like deer in a head. Deer looked like deer in the headlights, even though I had no headlight on my bicycle. I bet I looked the same to the deer. And I hit the deer and flipped over and landed on my right shoulder, and it broke everything across my body. So 18 broken bones, and two of the broken ribs punctured my lungs. And that put paid to my attempt last year to ride this race. Yeah, it was pretty wild. I was taken by ambulance. Fortunately, somebody called an ambulance. A motorist there. Ambulance came and put oxygen over my face and got me to the hospital in time. Although I have a little video, selfie video in the ambulance where I asked the EMTs to take the oxygen off so I can record me going to the hospital in an ambulance after colliding with a deer. That's just really how pathetic I am. Anyway, in the hospital, we'd be interrupted over and over again by all the healthcare professionals. Excuse me, but did you really hit a deer while bicycling? Yes, I did. Yeah, so I'm back.
You are truly the evil Knievel of guitar journalism here, and probably of law professors, for all I know. Who knows?
Well, as far as I know, right. Most of them just ignore me. They don't know what to say.
How long is it going to take you to get to that Mexican border?
1 to 2 months. I have a hard time estimating this. One, I want to make sure I take time to document it. Two, there's no reason for me to rush. I want to make sure I don't get injured. I'm 68 years old with all this stuff that's happened to me in recent times. And then carrying all my gear. So if I do 50 miles a day with all that climbing, that's 27 days, 54 days, 2,700 miles, throw in a rest day every week, 2 months. I go 100 miles a day. It's half that or a month with the rest of the day. So my best guess is somewhere in between there. I'm meeting up with some people early on. We'll talk about that momentarily. And I budgeted out 50 miles a day. So I'll stay at that at the start. And it may get to the point where I ride more miles a day or fewer. I think maybe more, but I don't know. But I'm just lucky that I have the summer off and sabbatical in the fall from my teaching job. So yeah, it doesn't matter. I can just mosey along or flat out, you know, put my head down and power through either way.
Just touch that border and keep riding to Connecticut.
I have thought about when I hit that Mexican border, turn right, turn west, and go over, it's about 75 miles to the place where I grew up on a ranch about 2 miles north of the Mexican border there, a cattle ranch. It has occurred to me that I might do that, although I suspect I probably want to get off that little bicycle saddle and sit on something a little softer and broader at that point in time.
Yeah. And you have been training for this literally for years. You are one of the few people I know who can ride 100 miles on a bike at the drop of a hat. And so you've been working on this. This is not just some weird adventure here.
No, I've done, I think since my cancer, I've ridden well over 15,000 miles in those 3 years. Last year was around 6,000 miles. I have nearly 4,000 miles. I think it's 3,800 miles in this year alone with about 180,000 feet of climbing. So I've been averaging well over 200 miles a week, well over 10,000 feet of climbing this year. So I'm as ready as I can be. You know, I'm taking a few days off, resting my body, and I will never be more prepared for any physical activity than I am right now. I am feeling good. Yeah. Old guy out there pedaling, I'm feeling good and feeling lucky that I can do this.
That's so cool. What's the best way for folks to follow you?
Well, somewhere we can put in a link, right? But I have a little dot that will appear every 30 minutes, courtesy of my Garmin satellite communication device that is on my own Garmin granted webpage. And also I will be blogging for the Prostate Cancer Foundation. I will be posting to various social media, in particular Facebook and maybe Instagram. I'm an old guy. Instagram doesn't make that much sense to me. And there's something else called track leaders that will have me with other people, and will post, not only post my location, but post my average speed at that point in time. So, but I'll put some links. Yeah. So I'm making myself very visible. I wouldn't have done this probably pre-cancer. Cancer made me, I've always been a relatively private person until I got cancer. And just, you know, you want to see my scars, I'll drop my pants in a parking lot. I don't really care, because I hope that somebody can gain something from me. So you'll have a hard time missing me.
Yeah, it was not that long ago that you and I met in Nazareth, Pennsylvania, to the Martin Factory. And I remember you had like a mid-level mountain bike in the trunk of your car, and we're kind of getting into cycling, but this has not been a lifestyle for you for the last 20 years. This has all been relatively recent.
Yeah, I guess it's accelerated, at least virtually, if not physically. I was a longtime runner. For many years, I ran 70 miles a week, you know, 10 Monday through Friday, 20 on Saturdays. I did marathons. Got knee surgery and asked my orthopedic surgeon, did I run too much or have bad knees? To which he responded, yes. And slowly moved over to cycling just as a substitute for running, because my knees couldn't take it. And then became more and more invested in cycling and physical fitness as I aged. And it really, my urge to be fit really ramped up when I got sick. I haven't thought consciously about that, but I'm sure part of it was with cancer, just facing that, wanting to be really fit. Now, there's lots of data that exercise is really good with respect to cancer, but I've got to be an outlier, because if that's true, I wouldn't have cancer, or it would have cured itself. But anyway, I think part of it is just facing these physical challenges, and my best response, both physically, health-wise, but also mentally, has been exercise. So I've been obsessive about it. Mm-hmm. Really obsessive. Hey, I have all the fancy, you know, my bikes are now as fancy as my guitars. That's which means I have a shitty car and shitty clothes and that sort of thing, but I made good choices.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of ironic that you are probably the fittest you've ever been, and you also have cancer.
Yeah, that's probably right. I've been really fit for a long time. When my kids were young, and I was in my 40s, we had my wife and I had our kids late. We were both 38 with first and 40 with our second. I could run 10Ks with a kid in a jog stroller under 6-minute miles.
Oh, wow.
And win my age group. So I've been fit for a long time, but I think in terms of endurance, this is the fittest I've ever been. I really can go out, hop on a bike, ride 100 miles, a lot of hills in it. No big deal.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And again, I feel so fortunate. So many people can't do this. When I had my surgery and started my recovery, and so I would walk miles in my neighborhood. You have to have a catheter when you first have close your eyes, folks. This is not safe for work. You have to have a catheter for the first week or so after prostate surgery, because they snip your urethra and sew it back together. So you've got this tube into a bag that where your urine goes. And most people have a little, stay in a house, or if they want to go in a house, have a little bag they hide under a pants leg. Not me, man. I have a shopping bag with the tube coming down and just walking around the neighborhood. People would say, "Hey, John," and then go, "Oh," I'd see the tube coming down out of my pants leg. But anyway, the Yale Urology Department asked me to be a mentor for other patients. And I said, "Yeah, of course, I'll do that. Yeah, I'm happy. Just trying to give back," or, you know, part of it's giving back, but it's not all altruism. It makes me feel better about myself. Anyway, my first few mentees, I would say, "Oh yeah, this is what I've got, this prostate cancer recovery doc. Look what I've done." And I'm walking 5 miles 4 days after I'm out of my surgery. And my doc made me stay off my bike for a month. My first ride after a month was 25 miles. And within a month of that, I was riding 100 miles. And so people saw that and said, I don't want this mentor. This guy's insane. Give me somebody who's looked like a real person. So I've tried to back off on that and come to the conclusion that I'm very unhealthy in my healthy habits. It's obsession rather than a measured approach.
Wow. How heavy is this bike when it's loaded down with all your gear? Have you weighed it?
I have. I weighed it on some bikepacking trips last summer, after about 2 months after my deer wreck. I couldn't make the Tour Divide, but I did some multi-day bikepacking trips up in Vermont. Again, that's how obsessive I am. And it weighed about just under 50 pounds.
Okay.
That's with the water and I moved with 3.5 liters of water and my food. I'll have a few more things on the bike, the drone, for instance, and a few more clothes. In some places, I'll have to carry more water, but 50-ish pounds.
Okay.
I got a top-of-the-line carbon everything bike because, one, that's the only thing that was available. That's my story. I'm sticking to it. But also, it's a cancer bike. You know, so I don't know that I'll ever do this again.
Yeah.
So I got as light a bike to get that would still be up to the rigors of this crazy journey over the Rocky Mountains. So it, yeah, 50, 55 pounds. They're probably right around 50 pounds.
I know this thing passes through some fairly large towns and cities along with plenty of, like, where is everybody routes. What are you bringing for food? Do you have a handful of items that you're starting with that you know you will eat?
So I don't know how much to put in my suitcase to take to Banff. I probably won't carry that much.
Okay.
And I do have a little stove. Butane or propane, whatever that kind of gas is you put in these little camp stuff. It's tiny, so that I can heat stuff up, mainly instant coffee in the morning, but maybe some freeze-dried foods for camping, sort of stuff backpackers know about. Although there'd be very few places where I can get that. So my guess is peanut butter and jelly burritos. And that's because a tortilla typically has as many calories as a slice of bread, but it's pre-squashed. So you can throw it in your bike. And peanut butter and jelly, peanut butter lasts forever. The jelly lasts forever. You get some carbs, you get some protein, you get a little sugar with the jelly. And when I was bike packing before, that turned out to be my favorite thing. If you think about this, I'm going to need between 5,000 and 8,000 calories a day. It's an eating contest, right? To keep your body going up and down. You just need calories. So eat whatever. I've actually been a vegetarian for some years, and I've been working my stomach back to being more or less an omnivore, because I'm fearful that I'm going to come into town and it's going to have the only thing I can eat is one of those hot dogs and a little rolling grill.
Yeah.
You know, 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
Which says fresh Tuesday, but it don't tell you which Tuesday.
Yeah.
And that you got to eat it, right? I don't know that I can go down that path. There's a fantastic the world's finest endurance athlete, Lael Wilcox. And there's a video of her a couple years ago coming into a town and just squashing hot dogs into her mouth. And she has a little bag on the top of her bicycle. She opens up, dumps French fries in there and a bunch of salt, and it takes off. Right. And so it leads to that kind of thing. So folks who've done a marathon or some other 10K or whatever, you can calorie deplete for a day. You can just, you know, go to the end point of your ability to produce any more exercise. Right. And then recover in the next couple of days. I can't do that this time. So I'm trying to learn how to eat better while I ride. Typically, a 100-mile ride, I eat a couple of gels and I drink a lot of water and sit, right? But I can't do that every day because I'll be so calorie depleted. I need to figure out how to eat that many calories during the day. So it's a challenge for me. But I do think that the peanut butter and jelly burritos, at least for me, are the answer.
I love that in addition to fighting cancer, you've also been training for this ride, and you've also been training your stomach to eat meat again. Like, can you just, are you going to take up any other hobbies?
Well, I was thinking, you know, the SpaceX thing isn't working very well, as far as I can tell. So I'm going to start my own rocket company. Yeah. I think I'll become a rocket scientist. I mean, you know, the reason is because this tour dividing, it's not rocket science, so that's what I got to attempt next.
Yeah. I was also just thinking about you mentioned the rider who just dumped their fries in their bag of, like, you probably are just going to want to burn all your gear by the time you reach Mexico.
I think that's probably right. I can't imagine. Certainly the clothes.
Yeah.
You know, I carry two of everything and hopefully stop in town now and then for a hotel to get this thing. Probably you've heard about it. A shower. Yeah. Bathe once in a while.
Yeah, you are stopping at least a few times to take rest days and meet up with some people, many of whom you've met through the guitar community, right?
Right. One is you. You're going to ride part of Montana with me.
Yeah. If we have any listeners near Butte, Montana, who want to take John and I out to dinner, John deserves it. I'm just an interloper for a day, but yeah.
And I could be cheap, except I will eat a lot. It's one of, yes, you know, it's a cheap, exactly, restaurant, but I'll order three of the best things on the menu. Yes, I'm meeting you. One of really fun meetups will be with Linda Manzer, the great guitar maker, yeah, who will meet me, I think, my third night in Fernie, Canada.
Yeah.
And she has is reliving her childhood, having recently purchased a 1988 VW camper van.
Yes.
Had it, I guess, serviced. And she's driving it from Toronto across country to hang out with, or at least see, Joni Mitchell and Carlisle, right?
Brandi Carlisle.
And Brandi Carlisle.
Yeah, next week,
two of my favorites.
They are playing at the Gorge in Washington State. And Blake Mills is playing, and the High Women are playing the next night. It's quite a Brandi Carlisle weekend. But Joni Mitchell next week.
Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, the big one.
So when Linda reaches there, she's left at the concert. She's going to head back north and meet me. She said, it's a 1988 engine. I don't know that it'll make it. I said, well, mine's a 1955 engine, so I think you got a better chance than I do. So we're going to meet up. She's got a campsite reserved. We're going to meet at the campsite, which will be fun. A few days later, I will meet the guitar maker, Dan Roberts, who's based in Bozeman, Montana.
Yeah.
Having once been with Santa Cruz and then worked with Gibson, has been independent for some years. He's going to meet me in either Helena or Butte and bring a guitar to play. And I've got it. Other folks along the way are going to meet me. Meet my wife for a couple days in the Grand Tetons and Teton National Park, which would be cool. I'm riding with a young medical student, my surrogate daughter, who is an extraordinary bicyclist. She's going to meet me for the first week or two. I don't think she's resolved that. So yeah, and other people I haven't met, seen for sometimes 30 years, have found me through this thing these old people use now called Facebook, and going to meet me in the middle of nowhere. A great, great painter that I hadn't seen since she was on the faculty at Yale, probably 30 years ago, reached out. It's going to meet me. Some other people are going to meet me. Yeah, it's going to be this whole journey into, that Western geography that I love. I just love that Western geography. A place in my own body and my own mind that I probably have never occupied before. And a journey sort of through my life in terms of relationships. It should be amazing. Oh, it will be amazing. Won't be amazing in a good way, but anyway, it's the most audacious thing I've ever attempted.
It truly is. I think it's the most audacious thing anyone, at least in the cycling world, has ever. I know this has been done for the last several years, and lots of people start it, but what an adventure!
Yeah, I'm really, really thrilled. People ask me how I feel. I'm equal parts excited and terrified. I think it's probably a good sign. It seems like the most appropriate response to this kind of crazy adventure.
You've had a busy life in the world of law and teaching and music. When you get on a bike or do these long runs you used to do, are you able to turn off everything and just, get into that mode where you're just moving and you turn off all of life's distractions?
So when I was doing serious mountain biking, you could understand from, I think, a skiing perspective, where if you aren't in the moment, you're going to die. You're going to hit a tree or something,
sure.
Right? That I can do. But in all this other writing is more contemplative. I really like to have something else going on. And I've gotten into audiobooks. I think that's the best thing, a good plot. Keep my head out of the other stuff, right? And so when I'm not riding with people on this journey, I will do that. So yes and no. Yes and no, I think, is the best way to put it. But I love that physical exercise. I really love. I can't tell people, what's more boring than sitting on a bike for 8 hours a day pedaling? But I love it. I'm happiest on a bike. I cannot tell you why, right? I'm not for a moment. That was not the case before my cancer diagnosis and these close encounter with deer and close encounter with COVID. I think I liked it, but now I think it's just that I can feel myself alive, right? I can feel my body doing this thing, and it does something that's relatively impressive, right 100 miles. And I think that's it. I think it's sort of an existential experience for me. And that's why I've come to just crave and love it.
Yeah. What books have you brought?
Well, I use my library, so I can check out from my library audiobooks. So I won't bring any. I'll just download.
Sure.
And so I I really specialize in the that space along the continuum from the ridiculous to the sublime. So sometimes it's stupid mysteries,
okay,
with good prose, but a stupid mystery is a good thing. And sometimes it's the latest Pulitzer Prize winner. Probably on this journey, not too much heavy stuff. Nothing scary.
Yeah.
Nothing with deer in it, for instance.
Yes.
Or bears. But yeah, just a whole range. I was talking with students at a retreat for law students where I teach. And someone asked me how many books I read last year outside of law books. And it was 130. Because I'm bicycling all the time. And I listen to them at about one and a quarter pace or 1.4 pace. So I get them a little faster. Yeah. So I actually can't remember. I have, and I get them through my library so I can go look. That's how I found out. My library had 130 books that I'd either read in, like, and I also can't sleep at night unless I'm reading a book, which I use on, well, right now an iPad. I'll use my cell phone for reading at night on this journey. Yeah, just everything, you know, and some people call them beach books. I'm way too hyperactive to be on a beach. I last about 4 minutes on a beach. So I call them airplane books. But anyways, you know, it's schlocky stuff is fine. And then just great stuff. Colson Whitehead's, you know, yeah, books, most recent books, all kinds of stuff.
Okay. I know for a brief.
Oh, and always the Fretboard Journal podcast, right?
Oh, yeah. We have so many podcasts that could fill a whole day.
Right.
You learn about tube amps. You can learn about luthiers, whatever you want.
Best hot sauces.
Oh yeah, yeah. On the tube amp one, you finally came to your senses and decided not to do this. But you were thinking about some sort of carbon fiber travel instrument that you were going to strap onto your bike.
Yeah, not a guitar. A little bulky. I talked with the manufacturer who was going to give me a carbon fiber ukulele, and I just thought, no, I've got enough things to worry about. I don't want to schlep one more thing. And so, fortunately, Linda Manzer is going to bring a guitar from the plane. But, you know, I thought Carbon Uke, Manzer, I don't know, it's pretty close, but I'd probably go with the Manzer.
I'm meeting you in Butte. I'm going to try to keep up with you for a day. You then go through Jackson, you said. I know that the road goes through Steamboat Springs, Colorado, right, and then it works its way down to New Mexico. So, again, if anybody out there wants to cheer John on, we'll include a link for the GPS route and a way to reach out to you. You're pretty easy to get a hold of even when you're on a bike, though. So,
right?
Yeah.
Even when I don't have cell service, I have this satellite device. Yeah, please. It's called the Tour Divide. You can Google it. We'll also open a link. You can see where it goes. If it goes anywhere near your town and you got enough money to feed a hungry guy, meet up. And probably mask. I don't be bathing that often. But other than that, you know, no worries.
I know you got to finish packing. I know you got to get on your plane. I'm going to see you in Montana. But my final question is just like, have you thought about, I have the utmost confidence after all that you've been through that you're going to finish this thing. Have you thought about where you go from there? I mean, this seems like you're going to battle and you need to almost mentally prepare yourself for when you're done with it and how you fill that time and your mind.
I've just recently started thinking about how I come back into civilization.
Yeah.
You know, there would be so many things I miss about my life. You know, my wife, my kids, my cats, my bed, right? But I think after this extraordinary experience, I worry that everything else will become, pun intended, pedestrian. And I don't know. I mean, I'm 68. I'm going to teach another couple years till I'm 70. I've got film projects, book projects. I think those will occupy me, but I do worry that they won't seem that interesting to me. So we'll find out, right? We'll find out. I think fortunately, my health won't be good enough to do this thing again. So I don't need to worry about repeating this event. But some people end up doing that because they miss that extreme experience. Other people drop out a weekend and think and say to themselves, what the hell was I thinking?
Sure.
Yeah, I've just started to ponder. I do have the Fretboard Summit coming up, which I have to go to keep up with TJ, right?
You do.
So there's that goal. That's number one goal. After that, I'll find something to do.
Yeah,
for sure.
All right. Well, you've got a month at least on the bike to think about what your presentation at the Fretboard Summit's going to look like. You've got a month to figure out what you're going to do after this and what your next Fretboard Journal story is, most importantly. And Everything else in law, in life related.
That's right. And a friend not long ago described me as the world's luckiest unlucky guy. And I think that really encapsulates it, right? A lot of bad stuff's happened to me, but I've come through it. So I'm feeling very, very lucky, very, very fortunate, including the ability to write that next fretboard journal story and appear at the summit and say something semi-meaningful about life and guitars. We'll figure it out.
I'm also, lest I forget, going to include the talk you did. It was very informal, but it was very moving with Greg Voris of Groon Guitars at Artisan. And I don't think enough people have seen that YouTube video. It's about guitars, but it's about a lot more.
Yeah, Greg has MS, an advanced case of MS. And we did Guitars, Life, and Mortality, I think I called it. Yeah. And I was moved during that discussion. I spent some time trying to figure out how to structure it, but it didn't need. Greg is such a fascinating, articulate guy that we just sat and chatted. And I thought it was an extraordinary experience for me, just a beautiful experience for me. So I hope other people find it that way. And if you want to find an inspirational person who puts me to shame, Greg Voris, unbelievable guy, unbelievable. Listen to that, reach out to Greg, or just worship him from afar, but an extraordinary conversation.
Yeah, frequent. He's appeared in a lot of Groon guitar repair videos. He was the guitar repair guy at Groon and is still at Groon. A super moving, beautiful talk with two incredibly beautiful human beings. I'm going to throw you there too.
Well, thank you. It was such an honor for me to do that.
Yeah.
And I bonded with Greg. I know it's a cliche to say it, but he's now a brother.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, John, good luck.
Well, thank you. I'll need it. And remember, break this into two segments, right? So that I can have the most appearances on it.
Well, here's what I am going to do. I'm going to bring a little microphone recorder and I'm going to do the next installment in Butte, Montana. And we are going to talk about the journey that you've been on and where you're going and how it's feeling. And so that will be the second installment of the John Thomas Adventures on the Fretboard Journal podcast.
The record is mine, folks. Don't even attempt it.
You got to ride even further than John to even make the cut of the Fretboard Journal podcast at this point.
Always a pleasure and privilege, Mr. Hillen.
Well,
thank you so much.
Go back to packing. You'll forget a few things, I'm sure, but Banff is a big town in Canada with lots of outdoorsy stores. Load up on whatever you forgot.
Sure, put a credit card. For sure, don't worry about it.
All right, I'll see you in Montana.
Take care.